Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet. This is episode 277 of Registry Matters. Good evening, sir. How are you?
Doing awesome.
Be sure to go over and like and subscribe on YouTube. 5-star reviews. You know the drill. Everyone says make the notification bell. All those things so that we can feed the algorithm and then other people can find the program. If you're new to the show, though, you can not only find us on YouTube, but you can also download the podcast and listen to it in your favorite podcast app, which is my favorite thing. I have an old phone by my bed, Larry, and I have podcasts and I have it hooked up to a speaker there. And that's how I listen to podcasts when I go to sleep. It's a really great way to woo yourself, lull yourself into sleep.
I do a similar thing, except I'm always listening to YouTube.
Oh, do you really?
I put the phone next to my head and I just start listening to stuff I want to hear until I fall asleep.
But hold on, though, your screen stays on because you're not paying for YouTube. So the screen stays on. You have this like blaring into your room.
Well, I usually wake up and turn it off.
Oh, I see. All right, then. Well, do me a favor, since we're not going to banter because we had too much of that crap last week. What are we doing tonight?
Well, we have a cert petition to the U.S. Supreme Court from Florida. We have a situation in Wyoming that has gained some national attention. And we have a story from Ohio of a preteen that is being threatened with prosecution for sexting. And we have a case that was just discussed and decided by the Michigan Court of Appeals for the next episode. I've not had enough time to read it because it just materialized today, but it was a challenge under the cruel and unusual punishment clause.
And so tell me something real quick, though, at first blush about the case. Do you think that he can reverse it with the state Supreme Court?
I don't think
it's terrible. It's just terrible.
That's why I like it. It's a great laugh. So at first blush, I think it's very unlikely that he's going to be able to reverse it. And I'll tell you why. Do you remember the case from Colorado, Millard v. Rankin? We had an old federal judge named Richard Mache.
I do remember that. And,
yes, Judge Mache wanted to grant relief under that clause, and he did, in fact, grant relief under that clause. A challenge that was initiated by an attorney. Her name was Allison Ruttenberg.
I remember.
And she succeeded with no money for expert witnesses and secured a favorable outcome at the district court level. And I pontificated it would be overturned by the Tenth Circuit on an appeal, and it was. And with all the resources that Judge Mache had available to him and wanting to grant relief, if he could not find enough legal grounds to sustain the relief, it's hard for me to conceive of Michigan being able to, in a state court, to be able to find those grounds, because the cruel and unusual punishment clause is very difficult to meet that standard. According to the originalist and the textualist, we have to look at how, when the Constitution was drafted, what punishments would have been considered cruel and unusual in that era, not by today's evolved standards, but by that time, at that time. Well, it's hard to think of a registry at that time, if there had been such a thing, but putting people to death was widely accepted and not considered cruel and unusual. Taking that into as the basis that you can't find juicing people with gas and with electricity and bullets and a hangman's noose, if you can't find any of that to be cruel and unusual, I think Alabama's invented some kind of new potion that they're using for executions now. If that's not cruel and unusual, it's hard to imagine that being on the list is going to be cruel and unusual. So I think it's going to be tough. But we're going to get into it on the next episode and dig deeper into the case.
Very well. Let me get my screen rotator thing working again. All right. Well, let's begin with a story from Wyoming. And it says, A young woman from West Virginia told members of the Wyoming Legislative Committee on Tuesday that a youth pastor who groomed her when she was a teenager is living in the state without accountability. Maddie Morgan told the Joint Judiciary Committee that when she was 12, her youth pastor groomed her by posing as a boy her age online. When I was 12 years old, she said, I was approached through social media by someone posing as a 16-year-old boy living in my state, who turned out to be my 31-year-old pastor. She said the youth pastor groomed her, sending her explicit photos and messages to her for 2 years before he got caught. She is unhappy that he is not registered in Wyoming.
You're correct. She's very unhappy that he's not registered, and he's not required to do so under Wyoming law.
And to give a little bit more context, the man left West Virginia after serving his sentence, Morgan said, and was no longer required to be registered in the state. She said he was ordered to comply with the registry requirements of the state he moved to. Upon finding out that her former youth pastor had moved to Wyoming, Morgan said she contacted the Wyoming Division of Criminal Investigation. The agency told her that there wasn't a state law equivalent to the crimes he was convicted of in West Virginia.
Yeah, and the girl stated, quote, he cannot be held to the lifetime registry requirement that I was promised as a child. Even though I was promised justice, I do not feel that it has been given to me since he found a loophole in the registry.
The bill draft that the lawmakers were discussing when Morgan addressed the committee would make 6 criminal penalties a part of the state's PFR list. The charges contained in a bill draft are sexual servitude of an adult, felonious restraint, and that's when the victim is a minor and is committed by someone other than the parent or guardian, false imprisonment. Same rules apply as the previous thing with the parents, if it's not a parent or guardian. Sexual servitude of a minor, first-degree human trafficking, and second-degree human trafficking. Do you think that this bill can be defeated?
Possibly, but it's going to be difficult. Morgan warned the committee that the man who groomed her is now heavily involved in a Wyoming church, noting that he is a featured guest on an episode of the church's podcast, and there's no law in your state. This is a quote, there's no law in your state to prevent him from doing this again, Morgan said. This is enough for me to come out and say that everyone needs to hold him accountable for what he did.
And I imagine that you being the legal strategist, pontificator of the universe, that you have a strategy, and would you be so willing to enlighten the audience?
Well, I would be able to come up with a strategy. I can't guarantee you success. But I can almost guarantee you that the strategy that most opponents of it will try is doomed to failure, because they will try to come in with reams of documents, and they will tell people that registries are not effective and that it doesn't reduce recidivism. And that's not the issue in play here. We have to look at the issue in play here and focus on that issue. This would be a good lesson, like when Texas was trying to prevent the smaller towns from being able to have their own registry. And the issue before the legislature is, why can big cities with home rule not have, why can they have prohibitions, and why are smaller towns not allowed to have that? The issue here is, why is this man able to live in Wyoming not being registered? And that's where you focus. So, and I doubt anybody will be able to carry out the strategy. And I admit it'd be a long shot, but it centers on 3 points. Registration is a civil regulatory scheme. Can you utter those words? Because no one can that's in advocacy.
I can. It's a civil regulatory scheme. I was totally going to ask you about this. She's talking about he's not being punished, but it's a civil regulatory scheme, which shouldn't be punishment.
That is correct. And that's what you have to address. There's not a soul in the Wyoming legislature that knows that it's a civil regulatory scheme. The last time they did a major overhaul was when they became substantially compliant with the Adam Walsh Act. And that's been many years ago, close to a decade ago, maybe even more than a decade ago. And there's hardly anyone around that's thought about the registry much since then. And therefore, they don't know that. So this is your teachable moment. The young lady is mistaken about it. He did pay his debt to society. He was punished by the state of West Virginia. We don't get to punish him again because West Virginia punished him for his actions. What he's dealing with now is a registration civil consequence of his behavior. And had he stayed in West Virginia, he might be required to register. But Wyoming has its own rules. So you've got to make sure civil regulatory scheme is top on the agenda. and educate them that this is not a part of the man's punishment. And when you do that, you might gain some traction. But the first step I would do is reach out to committee, because they plan to revisit this in November, according to the article. And you really want to lean heavily on the Wyoming being in a unique club of states. They're in one of 18 that have been deemed as having met the tough threshold of AWA compliance. They've been deemed by the feds. We have one of the 18 toughest registries in the nation. That works to your benefit in this argument. You say, well, wait. Maybe West Virginia has too many things on their list, because we've got everything that's required by the feds to be registered. We're already doing that. That's why they deemed us substantially compliant. And you probably would want to eliminate the word substantially and say that's why we were deemed compliant with the federal guidelines. And we're getting our money because we've met those tough criteria that the feds put forward. So West Virginia, we can't speak for what they're doing there, but we've met or exceeded what the feds require. And so you've got to make sure that they understand that, that Wyoming is in a unique club, and you're proud of that as an advocate. We're very proud to be in this club of only 18 states that have been able to achieve that designation, and we have a very tough registry for our citizens here. So, now, do you think you can have an advocate that would say those words?
It doesn't even sound that complicated.
Yes, but no one is going to say how proud they are to have an AWA compliant state. You're not going to find a soul that's going to be willing to go in and do that.
It seems like both of those points, you haven't even gotten to point three yet, I don't think. So the first two points seem like that would shut the whole thing down.
Well, but I'm saying in terms of someone who would be a PFR advocate, can you visualize sure. them going in and saying how great it is that we're in a compliant state and we've already got a very tough registry, which is very good for our citizens?
I don't know the right way to word this, but you're like tapping the ball into the net saying there's nothing more that we're not required to do it. So why should we have to do more than what we already have?
Well, but you need to be proud of your state.
Right. I gotcha. You're doing it very, very fakely, which I know isn't a word, but you're doing it very, very, you're doing it under dishonest intentions, I suppose.
I have an audio clip for that. Would you play it, please?
Oh my God. Which one am I supposed to play? I don't have, what am I playing?
Bear Bryant.
Oh, trying to win the game. Gotcha.
That's what we're trying to do here. We're trying to win the game. And so those are your big points, but you've got another point. This is one that would probably be more likely that you could do. You've got a possible equal protection clause violation, and the United States Constitution has an equal protection clause, and the Wyoming Constitution likely does as well, but I haven't read the Wyoming Constitution. And you would want to really center your arguments on that and say, you know, there's a bunch of liberal lefties called NARSAL.
I've heard of them.
And they love to go around the country litigating and trying to cause problems. And what we need to do is to make sure that we don't violate any constitutional provisions like the Equal Protection Clause. This man moved here. He's a resident of our state, and he's entitled to equal protection of our laws. And we can't single out an individual to try to punish, because clearly that's what this woman wants, is to try to punish him more because she's not satisfied. We can't do that because it violates the Equal Protection Clause, and we don't want those liberal lefties coming in here with a legal challenge, because this is a vital public safety tool for our citizens. And we don't need to be spending a whole bunch of money embroiled in court challenges like they had in Pennsylvania that went on for a decade, they had in Michigan that went on for nearly a decade, and they're going on all over the country. And that's what these people do. We don't need that here. We've got a great registry. We need to just tell her we're really sorry, but our registry does not require him to be on it. And he's turned over a new life here, and we're sorry. And of course, there's one thing that conservatives claim that they like. He's a taxpaying citizen, productive in the state of Wyoming, and that's what they say they're for. We've got a man here paying taxes, and he hasn't broken any laws that we're aware of. And that's all speculation that what he might do.
What is the counter argument to your first part about that he, that it's a civil regulatory scheme, the whole claim that he is not being punished? What would be their response to that if you're saying that he is not being punished, but it's a civil regulatory scheme and it can't be punishment? Doesn't that start you down this like death spiral of talking about the Kennedy Mendoza?
It does. You wouldn't need to go there because you're gracious to the young lady. You say she's very mistaken about this. The prosecutor should not have told her he would be required to register for life, because even had he stayed in West Virginia, that's a promise that the prosecutor could make, because the laws are not carved in stone. They could change. Perhaps he might have been required, but that was still, even in West Virginia, that was a civil regulatory scheme. It was not a part of his punishment. His punishment was his prison and any probation or parole that followed his sentence, which has expired. And it's a tragic thing that a prosecutor would tell her such a thing. Maybe she even misunderstood it as a young 12-year-old. But the fact is, this is not a part of his punishment.
But the point that I'm trying to get at, Larry, is that the title of the article is Victim Warns Judiciary Committee that some PFRs go unpunished in Wyoming. And these wouldn't even be PFRs anymore if they're not required to register. So these are previously PFRs. And so she thinks that this guy's getting through a loophole. And I'm wondering then what would be the argument from the the Judiciary Committee. What would be the argument from the Judiciary Committee that they are going to go forward and try to apply laws to this guy after the fact, if it's not punishment and she wants him to be punished?
That is the argument I'm making. We can't do that in a civil regulatory scheme.
Right.
We cannot do that. She's misguided, and we can't do that. We run severe risk of having our great registration scheme toppled by a legal challenge. We've got a compliant registry. It's a very tough one. We're one of 18. We need to leave it alone.
I like it. I like your strategy.
But nobody's going to do it.
I see. And let's just say we had a mythical clone of Larry Wyoming. So your name is now Larry Wyoming, and you're approximately 150 years younger. And you went in there and you were lobbying, even if you didn't really have many relationships, if you're just talking to like your local representative that you've just recently met. How well is this sort of argument going to go?
I would expect it would be very cordially received. I'd suspect that they have not heard these arguments before. And I suspect that they would give it a lot of consideration. I don't know if they would go my way, but they would be provided thought that they've never had before. And the people who are inclined to carry the reams and reams of stuff, please don't do that. It does no good. I would carry this in on one sheet of paper.
Sure.
I would have 4 points that I would make. And I would be able to do it in my 3 to 5 minutes that I would be lucky if I got, since I don't know these people. And I would probably be given a few minutes to speak in public hearing, and I think it would have a chance of working. But that's not the way most people pursue it. They're going to go in with volumes of stuff, and they're going to talk about recidivism.
I knew that.
And they're going to talk about everything that is irrelevant. What's relevant here is that this is a civil regulatory scheme. He's paid his debt to society. Wyoming doesn't register this offense, and therefore, we can't single this man out for unequal treatment. If he commits a new sex offense here, he'll be registered, prosecuted, and probably put in prison as a repeat offender for the rest of his life.
Yeah, I would imagine, especially the repeat offender part, he's definitely going to have some heavier book thrown at him than the first time. And we didn't even cover how long he served on the first stint.
I'm not sure if that was even clearly delineated in the article.
Well, all right. So there you go. There's your advocacy lobbying lesson for the day. Shall we move on to this next article?
Sure. This one's going to be a good one as well.
Very well. And this one, like I said, is from Florida. And this is before the U.S. Supreme Court. And you call it court, I believe. And I was going to, I had some plans, but you put this in there, so I had to read it. Why did you wait till the last minute to put this one in?
Well, because I just found out about it. So you canceled your plans this afternoon just
Absolutely.
To read this stuff?
Yes. I've been sitting here like flipping through all the pages, all of them.
I see.
You need to figure out your pipeline and get this stuff earlier than the day before. And this isn't coming from the Florida Action Committee. And is this the first time you've ever heard of this case?
It is indeed, and I'm not sure if Florida Action Committee has anything to do with it.
I'm still baffled at how stuff just shows up like it's on the doorstep, and these things take years and years to develop, and no one's ever heard of them. And the case that we're talking about is Clements versus the state of Florida. And I went through and I read it a whole bunch of times. I read it 3 times, and I'm convinced that it's a good case. And do you mind if I set it up?
Go ahead.
All right. 2017, Clements filed a pro se. Boy, oh boy, that's your favorite thing to start with. He filed a pro se petition for a writ of habeas corpus in the United States District Court of the Middle District of Florida, pursuant to section 2254. The state moved to dismiss, arguing that the district court lacked jurisdiction because Clements was no longer in custody. Clements replied that the burdens of PFR registration, along with all the other restrictions that come with being a registered sex offender, should be sufficient to establish custody. You absolutely love pro se litigants.
I do indeed. I'd love for them to stop making bad case law.
What did the district court decide?
The district court, they dismissed this case for lack of jurisdiction because Clements was not in custody.
Clements then appealed to the 11th Circuit. How did they resolve the case?
Well, as the Court of Appeals framed it, the proper inquiry for resolving the question presented is whether Florida's registration reporting requirements substantially limit Mr. Clements' actions or movement. The court concluded that they do not. It reasoned that petitioner is not at the beck and call of state officials because his reporting requirement is periodic and predictable. Furthermore, he is not required to live in a certain community or home and does not need permission to hold a job or drive a car. And lastly, while he must provide in-person advance notice of trips outside the state and outside the country, the trips themselves do not require permission or any state officials.
But he does have to, I guess does he have to get permission to work at a particular place? Wouldn't he have to do that with the 1,000-foot, 2,500 rules that exist in Florida?
No, he doesn't get any permission. You can move anywhere you want to. Now, you may get prosecuted for being in an exclusion zone, but you don't have to ask anybody for permission.
God, that sounds almost like entrapment. Almost. Well, let's move over to the present, though. Clements has filed a petition for certiorari, or cert, from the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. This means that Clements has now asked the Supremes to take a look. The Supremes, Larry?
Well, not literally this group, but the Supreme Court of the United States.
He has the Supreme Court of the United States to take a look at it. He's using habeas corpus as a vehicle. Tell me what you think about that strategy.
I'm not terribly optimistic.
Tell me what habeas corpus is in, like, really dumb it down, because I hear this term a lot, and again, it's Latin, and I have no idea what it means. I've heard it and don't know.
It's a person who's in some form of custody that believes their custodial status is not lawful, and they're seeking an order to be brought before a court for the custodian that's holding them to have to justify their detention. And the key word that Clements is dealing with is custody. Mr. Clements is not in custody as the term custody is defined.
And he's completed all of his obligations of his sentence and is only on the registry in Florida?
That is correct.
You can't understand that registration with all the requirements is not the same as being on probation and parole. You can't put those two together?
No, I cannot, because it's not the same by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, as usual, Larry, you're pretty cantankerous. And the person on the registry does have many duties and obligations that are similar to supervision. And it's sad that you can't see that.
Oh, I can see the similarities, but there are differences that distinguish one from another. A person on probation is subject to a plethora of rules, such as no recreational drugs, no alcohol use, no significant financial transactions without the probation officer's approval, restrictions of who they can associate with, prior approval for travel. Other than Alabama, I know of no state that requires a PFR to have a permit to travel when they're only on the registry and not, you know, under any form of supervision. Registrants are not subject to curfews, with maybe exception of a Halloween curfew, but they're not subjected to drug testing, polygraph testing, and on. For you to say it's the same, it's just simply not true. It's not the same. It's inconvenient, but it's not the same as being under supervision. Your registration cannot be revoked. Supervision can.
Being on the registry and failing to comply with something would put you in custody really quick.
Yes, but that's a violation of the registry. Your probation can be revoked for a technical violation like missing curfew. Your registry doesn't get revoked because you're out past a certain time of night.
I'm going to come up with a way to beat you on this argument, Larry. But before we get to that, let's get into the essence of this case. The question presented is whether a person is, quote-unquote, in custody within the meaning of Section 2254 if that person remains subject for the rest of his life to a state law PFR registration scheme that, among other things, compels his frequent physical appearances for in-person reporting at particular times and places and limits the circumstances under which he may travel, all under the threat of criminal sanction. Can you admit that Clements is in custody now?
I cannot. I cannot admit that. Since 1874, a person seeking federal habeas corpus relief from a state court judgment must, among other things, be in custody. The in-custody requirement has remained unchanged through subsequent legislative revisions and the various habeas corpus statutes. And even more recently, the Anti-Terrorism Effective Death Penalty Act passed by Congress in 1996, which restricted habeas relief, but it left intact the in-custody language in Section 2254. And according to the 11th Circuit, Congress did that when they enacted the dramatic changes to post-conviction relief as part of that Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act. That did not affect the Supreme Court's custody in-custody jurisprudence. And I can't see how you guys can say that he's in custody when he's not in custody. He's not in any form of custody that's been recognized, even with the expanded custody, not being just physical custody, but under supervision, reporting to a parole or probation officer, he is not in custody.
According to Clements, the court should grant review to resolve the split and bring the 11th Circuit's precedent back in line with the Supreme Court's holdings. Proper resolution of the question presented has profound practical consequences for hundreds of thousands of individuals nationwide who are denied federal habeas review of their state court convictions despite facing lifetimes of significant restrictions on their liberty. The court's guidance on Section 2254's custody requirements is sorely needed, as confusion surrounding its application has produced arbitrary and inconsistent results among the circuits. Now, what do you say to that?
The results are not all that inconsistent. There was only one circuit that has split. The rest have determined that PFR registration does not meet the in-custody requirements of federal habeas. So I don't know what he's talking about, because he's only cited one circuit. And in fact, I think we talked about that case, and we'll get to it later. But I don't know all these splits. There really is no split. There's a renegade circuit, and the rest of them have consistently interpreted the way I think the law was intended to be interpreted.
28 U.S. Code Section 2254 specifies that the Supreme Court, a justice thereof, a circuit judge, or a district court shall entertain an application for a writ of habeas corpus on behalf of a person in custody pursuant to the judgment of a state court only on the ground that he is in custody in violation of the Constitution or laws or treaties of the United States. The issue here is whether Clements is in custody per Section 2254.
And you finally got that correct. And he's not in custody. Why can't you see that?
Let's cover what the requirements are to see if custody, if the registration requirements are like probation. Report to the local sheriff's office in person every 3 or 6 months, depending on the offense. If homeless, the requirement is monthly. Report in person within 48 hours of any change in address or vehicle registration. Report in out-of-state travel plans, including 48 hours before out-of-state domestic travel lasting more than 3 days. 21-day advance notice of international travel. Report online within 48 hours any changes to employment, telephone number, email address, or internet identifiers. Please, you gotta agree with me that these are probationary in nature.
Well, I guess I could agree with you that some of those are probationary in nature, but I cannot totally agree with you because a person under supervision must seek prior approval for doing most, if not all, those things. A PFR does not need prior permission to do any of those things. He or she must simply report those activities.
And what would happen if you don't report the activity?
The same thing would happen if you don't get your restaurant inspected and have your temperatures at the right level. You either get shut down or locked up. But if you do those things, you're fine. If you do the things, you're not in custody.
I pretty much that you're hopeless. Because suppose you were a day laborer, Larry, and you changed employers every day. You would then have to go to the popo office and update your stuff pretty much every day. You wouldn't be able to maintain a lifestyle like that. That would be equivalent to being in custody at the local sheriff's office.
Well, that's like saying if I own a cat and the city ordinance requires me to restrain my cat to my own property, that I can't do that. That's your problem to figure out how to do that. If you're on the PFR registry, you got to figure out how to comply with the terms of your registration. And I don't know if you can report the change of employment any other way than in person, but if you had to report a day labor job, if you couldn't just simply report that you're working for a day labor outfit, and if that outfit changes, if you had to report each location, that would definitely be cumbersome. But as long as you report it, you're fine.
You're hopeless. Other provisions of Florida law restrict where registrants are permitted to live. Registrants are forbidden, in particular, from residing within 1,000 feet of any school, childcare facility, park, or playground, or pretty much where any other humans are living. The 11th Circuit has recognized that such provisions create vast, vast exclusion zones in which registrants are barred from residing, a condition that especially burdens those with families, citing McGuire versus Marshall. Oh my God, I can't read that thing. What is that?
Don't worry about it.
Okay. So what's your spin on that take?
That was the McGuire versus Marshall case from Alabama that we talked about. And that was the one who kept calling. No, he didn't keep calling, but he did go in at his brother's behest to check because he had never been registered or required to register in Colorado.
Right. That's the cat from Colorado. I gotcha.
Yeah. And that's the one who went in and his brother told him, now you go down there and you be a good boy and you check. And his brother was a lawyer, didn't know jack about registration. And they kept them there all day. And they said, by the way, we've got all your paperwork from Colorado and you are covered here. And if you don't register today, we're going to lock you up.
God.
But still, in terms of your question, my spin, he's still not in custody. These are provisions of the regulatory scheme. The person does not need permission to reside at a particular address. They simply need to respect the limitations of the exclusion zones. Clements is relying too heavily on a case from the Third Circuit, and I'm going to try to pronounce this. It's Piasecki versus Court of Common Pleas, Bucks County, PA. And that's for those legal beagles, 917, Federal 3rd at 161. And that was a Third Circuit decision from 2019. And I think we discussed that case at the time. It was a fantastic holding that he was in custody for habeas purposes, but it's an outlier and it's not in the mainstream of jurisprudence.
When we were prepping for this, you pointed out that there was a significant mistake in the cert petition. Would you enlighten the audience upon that?
Yes, and it's very funny. On page 9, the paragraph reads, quote, "The Fourth Circuit came to the same conclusion as the Sixth with respect to the analytically identical Texas registration requirements. And Wilson versus Flaherty," and that's a case from the Fourth Circuit in 2012, "the petitioner faced a similar in-person reporting requirement and limitations on travel. Despite all of this, the court held that the Texas requirements lack the discernible impediment to movement typically associated that satisfies the in-custody requirement. The only problem, the reason why this stood out like a sore thumb, is because Texas is not in the Fourth Circuit. So that caused me to go look up the case, and the case is actually from Virginia, not Texas. And you legal beagles out there, If you're going to brief the U.S. Supreme Court, make sure you have your citations correct. Shame on you for being that careless. This is an important case, and you cite something incorrectly like that.
I could see kind of like getting the districts wrong, but like Texas isn't anything like Virginia. Just pointing out and being pedantic. But tell me what's next.
Well, Clements is actually still alive at the moment. The state of Florida declined to respond to the petition, which is customary, and you've asked about this before. You receive 8,000, the Supreme Court receives 8,000 to 9,000 cert petitions, and only about 1% are going to be granted. So therefore, if you responded to everybody that filed a cert petition, you would be answering 8,000 petitions that don't need to be answered. So they waive response, and they wait to see if the court is interested. The court has ordered a response, and I think it's due either Monday or very soon in the coming days. And then it'll go to conference, and they'll decide if they have the four requisite votes to grant cert. So he's alive.
And as usual, you're Mr. Doom and Gloom. But since they're interested, which means there's hope, right?
Well, that's one way of looking at it. But there's a basis for me to come to the conclusion. The court has had at least two opportunities to help PFRs in recent years. Do you remember a case from the state of Michigan, Doe's versus Snyder? Does that ring a bell?
That does ring a bell.
Do you remember Michigan asked the Supreme Court to take a look? They requested cert. And what did the Supreme Court say in response to that cert petition? They could have helped PFRs. They could have done what? They could have granted it, right?
Right. They denied it.
Okay, then Pennsylvania, the name of the case has escaped me because I've had so many, but they filed a cert petition. A county prosecuting attorney did not like the Pennsylvania Supreme Court's decision, and they sought U.S. Supreme Court intervention. And what did the U.S. Supreme Court do? They could have said, yes, we want to look at this, and that would have had the effect, had they affirmed, they would have had the effect of overturning Smith versus Doe. What did they do in that case?
I'm going to go with they denied cert on that one, too.
They denied cert on that one. So if they had really wanted to revisit Smith versus Doe, they could have granted review on either of those. And in my humble opinion, if they grant review of this case, the danger is they will affirm the 11th. And if they affirm the 11th in this case, they will extinguish the Third Circuit's favorable holding in Piasecki. And that would mean that everybody in that circuit who can use habeas as a vehicle will no longer have that vehicle. I can't imagine that the states that compose that circuit, where Piasecki is binding, if the U.S. Supreme Court says, nope, this is the way we see it, I can't imagine they would continue to entertain habeas petitions from people who are not in custody. So that's what my fear is.
Why do you think they would not expand habeas relief to include those on the registry?
Well, it would open proverbial floodgates to thousands. If there's 800,000 people in the registry, I would imagine, wouldn't you think at least 10% of them would like to get off?
I would imagine more than 10% would want to get off the registry if they had a vehicle.
Right. Well, if you open habeas to 80,000, let's just say conservatively, 10% will have the wherewithal and know-how and want to get off the registry. You've got 80,000 petitions dumped into the court system saying, I want habeas review. I want to reopen my case from 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago. And beyond that, Congress has mandated that there be an in-custody position of an individual seeking habeas. Now, I know our audience is very strict interpretation, and they don't want any legislating from the bench. This would be legislating a brand new vehicle from the bench.
I have a question, and I want you to think for a moment. Would there be a way to reword some of the laws, add amendments to it or something like that, that would make registration more like being in custody, even not necessarily in action, but in words?
I never have thought about that, but why would you want to do that?
That would make you a vehicle for you to run this habeas thing and that you're in custody. That's why.
Well, you've got other vehicles. You can use petitions for declaratory judgment. You don't have to use the habeas vehicle. But declaratory judgment is complicated. I can't even get lawyers to understand that that's the vehicle. In fact, I'm working on a case with a PFR in New Mexico that has a Colorado conviction. And he hasn't been able to find an attorney. So I told him, well, we've got a couple in the building. I'll recruit one for you. And I went down and talked to one that's on our floor. And I told him, this is what I'd like to do, but I need you to at least be on board. And he said, well, why do you want to file a petition with declaratory judgment? I said, because that's how we posed the question. He said, why don't you just file to have him removed from the register? I said, we don't have a process. But if we even had a process, that's still not the right vehicle, because we're questioning whether or not his out-of-state conviction is equivalent. And the proper vehicle is for a petition for declaratory judgment. And it took me 30 minutes to convince him. He says, oh, okay, I believe you. That's the way we'll do it.
May we move on now, Mr. Doom and Gloom?
I think I've run off every listener we have by now, but let's go.
Probably.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe button and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
All right, well, this article is from the Associated Press, and this is from Columbus, Ohio. When an Ohio father learned that his 11-year-old daughter had been manipulated into sending explicit photos to an adult, he turned to the police for help. Now, listen carefully. He turned to the police for help, but instead of treating the girl as a victim of the crime, an officer seemingly threatened to charge her under a law most people view as designed to protect child victims.
Well, I'd like for you to please admit that this is funny. Can you do that?
That is not funny.
Not funny.
No.
If you call the police and they are your friends and you've been a victim for crime and they don't help you, that's not funny.
It's not funny. I'm a father. It's not funny.
Okay. Well, anyway, the shocking interaction was recorded last week on body camera audio. Actually, it says by the father's doorbell camera.
Right.
In Columbus. The footage drew criticism from the public and from experts who saw law enforcement officials having long misused laws meant to protect children by threatening to charge them with being part of the same crime. Experts said the incident also showed that training for officers on how to respond to child exploitation cases is spotty and not standardized between police departments.
I have an opinion about those Ring doorbells, too. They're really, really bad. We can talk about that later if you want to. In the redacted body camera recording obtained by the Associated Press, the father asks if there's anything the police can do. A female officer is heard replying that his 11-year-old could be charged with creating child pornography. The parents protest that she is a child, a victim who was manipulated by an adult. It doesn't matter, the officer said. She's still creating it. The angry father ends the conversation and slams the door behind him. The video he posted to TikTok has been watched over 750,000 times as of Thursday.
Why can't you admit this is funny? I want you to, you and I need to agree on something funny on at least one episode.
This is not funny because as a father, I could see this happening to my kid, and this is still not funny.
So, but she is a person. Right?
She's a minor. She's therefore not a person.
she's a person, and she created this image, and she sent it. And Ohio law makes no exception.
Seriously, if a three-year-old grabbed a hold of your camera and happened to open the camera app, and it's in between diaper changes, and the kid takes a picture of their junk, you're going to charge a three-year-old?
Well, I wouldn't, but I mean, I did put my hand on the Bible.
It does say no exceptions. Good grief. All right, so Columbus Police Chief Elaine Bryant responded quickly in a statement that the officer's conduct was being investigated and did not meet the division's standards for how victims should be treated.
So, yes, and Columbus Police spokesman Andres Antiquera, and that's spelled A-N-T-E-Q-U-E-R-A, said the agency has a nuanced policy that considers each case individually, but that the focus is to protect the minor through education, counseling, and social services, not criminal charges. He said the department sometimes provides information on those resources to parents as well as referrals for services.
But Antequera said Ohio statutes are clear that minors who create, possess, or distribute images of CSAM, even of themselves, are violating the law. He said prosecutors ultimately decide whether to file charges, but he did not answer when asked whether Columbus police had arrested minors under similar circumstances in the past.
And Rebecca Epstein, the executive director of the Center on Gender Justice and Opportunity at Georgetown Law, said charges against victims are common. And Epstein co-authored a report in April at looking at how survivors of sexual assault and abuse are often criminalized. Quote, girls who experience sexual abuse are often the ones who are punished for the sexual abuse they experience, rather than being treated as survivors who need support. They're funneled into the criminal justice system, she said. Our culture assigns complicity to girls who are too young to legally even consent to sex. Remember, this is what happened in Maryland. Do you recall a case that we reviewed a couple, 3 years from the Maryland's highest court where a teenage girl was prosecuted and convicted of distributing images of herself?
I don't recall that one. I recall other ones that we've covered, but not that one specifically. But the Maryland High Court urged the legislature to change the law, though, did they?
To my recollection, they did not. No, I don't think that they've changed the law.
Which state was that in the Western state, though?
Oh, well, there's a bunch of liberal do-gooders in a Western state that has changed the law.
Which state is that?
New Mexico.
How was that done?
Well, it's really not that difficult. We just simply carved out an exception in our law for those who are under 18. Taking into account the reality of sexting as it's become known.
Did you guys find that difficult to pull off?
Oh, it was definitely difficult. The coming up with the language is not that hard. In fact, I'm sharing it with the world right now in this episode. But actually getting that passed, the law enforcement apparatus fought us vehemently. And the New Mexico Attorney General's office led that fight. And we gained the support of a courageous Republican state senator who really got us to the finish line. See, I'm bipartisan. I'll work with whoever I need to. In the end, it actually cost her dearly because the Republican Party withheld financial support and campaign assistance, which led to her being defeated in the 2016 general election by a liberal lefty Democrat.
What is the wording in New Mexico's law?
Well, I'm going to let you read it, and I'll fill in what the exceptions are. So go ahead and read the section of New Mexico law that deals with this type of activity.
All right. New Mexico Statute Section 30-6A-3, Subsection A, states, it is unlawful for a person to intentionally possess any obscene visual or print medium depicting any prohibited sexual act or simulation of such an act if that person knows or has reason to know that the obscene medium depicts any prohibited sexual act or simulation of such act, and if that person knows or has reason to know that one or more of the participants in that act is a child under 18 years of age. A person who violates the provision of this subsection is guilty of a fourth degree felony. Larry, why is that worded so awkwardly?
That's just a way that the cookie crumbles in this business.
Good grief. All right.
So, but subsection B is what saves the minors. Subsection B states that the provisions of subsection A shall not apply to a depiction possessed by a child under the age of 18 in which the depicted child is between the ages of 14 and 18 and the depicted child knowingly and voluntarily consented to the possession and the depicting child knowingly and voluntarily consented to the creation of the depiction or the depicted child knowingly and voluntarily produced the depiction without coercion. Now, that is not that hard to write in there, folks, in the other 49 states. I know we're not the smartest in the world, but we've got this language for you. You don't have to think it up. You can put this in your law and make this. And we've already thought about the thing about what about when there's coercion. If the prosecution can show that there was coercion, then the prosecution This subsection shall not prohibit prosecution nor create immunity from prosecution for the possession of depictions that were a result of coercion. So we've got that covered.
Do you think other states could use this as a model?
I think they could. Now, again, having the language is not the battle. The battle is trying to overcome law enforcement. Remember, they make a lot of arrests on this type of thing. It's like the biggest population in the federal prison system, and it's a significant within the state. If you think back on your stint, you probably knew of some people, and they are not going to want to lessen the number of prosecutions that they have, and they see this as a threat. So it's going to be hard to overcome their opposition, and I don't know how many courageous Republicans that you're going to be able to find like what we had here. She happened to have several minor children, and she recognized the danger. And she had a vested interest in keeping her children beyond the zone of prosecution because she had actually been a prosecutor at one time. And she understood if you give prosecution tools, they will use them. You have to strip them of those tools. And that's what the public doesn't understand. It's just like everything else with law enforcement policies and procedures. When they say it's standard operating procedure, it's only standard operating procedure because you haven't asserted the control that you have over your police, and you haven't told them you will police the way that we instruct you to do. But that is our right as citizens. We can define the boundaries of what our cops are allowed to do. They work for us.
His daughter was 11, and I'm trying to, like, literally there would be a district attorney that says, yep, this is blatant violation of the law, and we're going to charge your 11-year-old daughter with these crimes, and we're going to seek 5 years in prison?
Well, as a juvenile, you're not likely to get 5 years in prison, but again, it's possible. Depends on the state and the rigidity of how they punish juveniles. Here, no juvenile, even if it were prosecutable, no juvenile would ever be sent to incarceration for something like that. But again, we're very rehabilitative in terms of how we treat juvenile offenders. You've got states in the Deep South, in the forgiving Bible Belt, where they believe that juveniles should be treated very harshly. We've had articles that I've put off for 3 weeks now about the Angola State Prison, where the court ruled that they could not put juvenile offenders and house them at Angola.
I've heard about that.
And we haven't even gotten around to it yet. But that's down in the Deep South. And they believe that one way you teach juveniles and get their attention is to treat them very harshly. Put them in Angola. That makes perfect sense to me, doesn't it to you?
Without a doubt. I'm still trying, like, what do you do with the 11-year-old? Do you put them in, like, the juvie hall or something?
Yes, they would go in a juvenile facility. But again, if you take the tool away from the prosecution, as we did, you don't have to worry about this. You don't have to worry about the renegade prosecutor. I would say that 75-80% of the prosecutors would not never prosecute an 11-year-old.
I agree.
But what about one that does?
Right. I'm trying to play up the scenario there. I'm not trying to, like, take away the tool. I'm trying to play up the scenario of that the district attorney that does want to prosecute this because I can't even come up with a rational reason why. I guess, like, well, it's a law that's on the books and I must follow the law as the legislative body did it representing their population. They obviously wanted this. They would have made out a carve out if they didn't want it. So they obviously want the 11-year-old. Not only is the 11-year-old going to get charged with creation, but then also distribution of it because they sent it over the interwebs.
Well, again, some prosecutors would do it because it is the law and they have too many staffers in their office. And they're looking for something to do. Some may be in the middle of a heated contested re-election. There could be a number of reasons. But if you don't want it to happen, take the power away from them.
I gotcha.
So,
but the police are obviously overworked and underpaid, so, right?
Well, that's obviously, I would think, what this gentleman thought when he called the police. He would have never had any idea that police file charges and threaten people with charges. He would have listened all of his life that the police are good. They're here to help. They're overworked, short-staffed. The bad guys have all the rights. And he would have believed that. You all believe that until it comes home to you.
Yes, that is true. I'm with you on that one. Yikes. So, I can't see how this one. I'm trying to play out the scenario of putting an 11-year-old on the stand in cuffs and all that as an 11-year-old. The person's 4 feet tall. They have to use extra small jumpsuits for them. Can you see an 11-year-old being paraded around the courtroom?
It happens all the time.
Good grief. For something like this, I could just see her in little pigtails. This is ridiculous.
Well, not for something like this, but 11-year-olds get prosecuted all over this country. There's 9-year-olds. I think the youngest registrant in America is like 9 years old when I saw the UN report on America. So, yes, we do prosecute people for crazy stuff here.
We're exceptional, Larry. American exceptionalism at its best.
If you don't want that, you have to remove the power.
I totally understand. Is there anything else that you want to talk before we get out of here? This is ridiculous.
No, I should have accomplished my mission tonight.
And that is of running everyone else off?
Mr. Doom and Gloom, I've probably run off a dozen listeners tonight.
Well, did we get any new snail mail subscribers before we head out?
We did.
Do you want me to read it?
Tell me who it was. I forgot.
It's David in Ogdensburg, New York. Is that a facility or is that a free world person?
That is a facility that houses people that have been civilly committed, I do believe.
And we didn't use David is about as generic an English American name that you could come up with. So I try to not out anybody. But head over to registrymatters.co. Oh, wait, let me tell you real quick about the Ring doorbells, if you don't mind. Ring doorbells are terrible, terrible things. The company was originally Ring, and then they were bought by Amazon. And what therefore happens with the Ring doorbell is the video footage goes to the servers on the internet that it records, and it records your neighbors, it records all kinds of stuff. And the police then only have to go like file a request with Amazon to get the video footage. And if 10 people on your street have Ring doorbells, they have like all of the traffic moving around your neighborhood, and they only had to do a request without a whole lot of subpoena power because it's not in your control. They pulled it from somewhere else.
Well, that's
terrible
funny.
Things. Oh my God, it's terrible. It's terrible. Don't have a Ring doorbell. Anywho, so go over to registrymatters.co for the show notes, and hey, leave a voicemail message. We haven't had one in a while. 747-227-4477. registrymatterscast@gmail.com if you would like to leave a message. We record the show usually around 7 o'clock, unless Larry's late, at 7:30 on Saturday nights. And if you become a patron, you can listen to the program as we record it live, and you would become a patron over at patreon.com/registrymatters. And I don't have anything else, and if you don't have anything else, then we'll head out of here.
Thank you. We'll see you soon.
Have a good night, Larry. Bye.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.